So my name is Robert Rogers. I'm 55 years old, and I am here with my friend Joan Alden, and we are in Sarasota, Florida. Joan, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Joan Alden, and I'm 75, so I'm 20 years older than you. And I've lived in Sarasota about 5 years, and I was most of my adult life I spent in one coast to the other, either in New York or San Francisco, back and forth a couple times. And then when my partner passed away, I decided to move south because it's a place I'd never been. So it seemed like that would make a new beginning. And I first went to Charleston and was there for about 8 years and then came here.
That's my hometown.
Is that right?
I had no idea, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and then came down here after about 8 years, and my sister lives down here, so I moved into her house temporarily, and then a couple years ago now, I moved to Cityside. But in my talking to you and talking about the subject of Stonewall because of the anniversary, I thought it might be nice to recollect where I was and what I was doing at that time in my life. Now, that 50 years ago, I was 25. And I was in New York, in Manhattan, and I was taking classes at Stella Adler's drama school. And I hadn't been there too long when there was the raid at Stonewall. And I was just in my first relationship. And so that was relatively new. And then after the raid, there were riots in Manhattan. And it was an exciting time in the sense that this whole community of people who'd been hiding in the closet suddenly came out on the streets rioting. And it broke open the culture in a way. And both the larger culture that the gay community lived in and our culture broke open, and we spilled out on one another. And right shortly after the raid and riots, there was the first Pride March, and I was there at that march and marched that whole way. And that was a wonderful, exciting day. And what was remarkable about it, first of all, was that in 1969, the LGBT community, even if you were out to your friends and family, maybe even your work, you were not out on the streets in the sense that we didn't hold hands or make familiar gestures or put your arm around somebody or greet somebody with a kiss. As far as when we were in the public area, we were very circumspect.
Is that because there was the consistent discrimination, like open discrimination?
Yes, exactly. Because you were afraid of, for some people were afraid for their lives, but certainly everyone felt afraid for their income, you know, their job, and housing, and all the areas in which we weren't protected then. And also certain friends and family that you wouldn't want to hear about that you were gay or lesbian before you made that announcement. So there was always that issue also. But so on the street, walking around, this younger generation would not believe this, but we pretended like we were asexual, you know? And we, in any kind of conversation that we had, we would hide the fact that the other was of the same sex. So if you were in a conversation about what'd you do this last weekend, you would use all the correct pronouns to hide yourself from admitting that you spent the weekend with someone of your same sex. Mm-hmm. And so it was a big headache having to do this all the time. Mm-hmm. And even though I was out with my family and friends, I still wasn't out in the way that you can be now. I had to be careful who I was telling what to before I started telling the story of my life to somebody.
This sort of cloaked existence in a way.
Yeah. And it's, unfortunately, you get pretty used to it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so much so that it's routine. And then when you start gaining some access and acceptance, it's almost hard to make that reversal,
yeah.
to trust.
I would imagine,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some people that are my group, are contemporaries to me, never came out to family or friends and or work or anything.
So living
can't
most,
imagine that.
Yeah, right. So not really being able to be the authentic.
Certainly, rarely. I mean, you know, maybe there was some way of being authentic in your home, you know, away from everybody. But that's a terrible existence,
mm-hmm.
not to be
yourself.
And what happens as a result of that, if you don't already feel like a second-class citizen, you make yourself a second-class citizen by allowing those restrictions
mm-hmm.
to take over.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very dangerous area to get into, because once you assign yourself to less power and access in the world, you begin to be a jailer of your own self, and your self-esteem can't be too good in that situation.
The psychological impact,
right?
You know,
and so I made the choice right away. As soon as I was in a relationship with somebody, I made the choice to come out to the world. And the first people I told were my family members. And my parents were living over in England at the time. My dad was working for Ford of Europe. And so I wrote them a letter rather than face to face. And they immediately wanted to see me, so they wanted me to come over and visit and talk to them. And as true in all of our lives, whenever there's something really serious you want to talk about, you wait till the very last hour that you're together, and then
mm-hmm.
you start talking about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this long weekend that I had in England, neither my father or mother brought the subject up. You know, they wanted me to come visit them to talk about this,
mm-hmm.
This being my lesbian tendencies,
yeah.
and yet they didn't bring it up, and I wasn't going to bring it up. They invited me. They were, you know, whatever they were interested in knowing, they
could ask.
They could ask, right. So they waited till the last hour or two before I was leaving. And it was my father who spoke. My mother never said a word. When we were sitting, the three of us, in a rather formal room in the house, where you would have high tea, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and in chairs that were too far apart to really have intimate conversation,
mm-hmm.
you had to almost shout to hear to be heard, right? So it was the sort of thing that, as a writer, you make scenes this way, where you go against the current. So whatever the character is trying to do, or desires to do, or has to overcome, you put that character in an environment where it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So if they have to tell somebody like something, like your father's in the hospital, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't put them in a place where there's just you and this person that you've got to tell this to in your privacy of their apartment or something. No, you put them in a public place,
right.
So that it makes it much more difficult.
Right.
And that's called going against the grain.
Presents
and
this challenge.
It makes
right.
it much more interesting. So So that's what was going on when I was with my parents. Is they, my father finally said, and so we were in this formal room, and not at all conducive to family chat.
Right.
First stupid move of my mother's. My mother was engineering this. So well, she was engineering that she could be in a room. She could be far enough away from me, I guess, that she could deal with the shame or whatever she thought was going to come down. But of course, then it made it an obstacle. The room became an obstacle. So my father said to me, "Well, now, Joan, what exactly is your relationship with Allison? Are you like sisters, or like friends, or like mother-daughter?" And I said, "Yes, yes, yes, we're all that." And at various times, we are like friends, and sometimes we're like family. And I said, "But we got together for romantic reasons. And so we're more lovers than anything. And but we're all those things." And he wanted something more specific. Like, "What do you do in bed?" kind of specific.
Okay.
Because that's the usual straight question, you know, to a lesbian, or I imagine a gay man is, "So what do you do in bed?" And that is very telling, because it means that what they think of, what we think of as our sexual orientation, they think of as a sex act. Not as an orientation. Not that there's a full life experience about the culture of being gay and lesbian.
Right.
And
it's all about intercourse.
And that's not what they're
really
interested in. They're just interested in the sex act. So that was my father. So he was, you know, "Well, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, we do what you do. You know, we go to movies, we, you know, read, we, you know, cook." And he said, he said, "No, I meant, what do you do as lovers?" And
that had to be a rather awkward
and
question.
And I thought, what a dumb ass he is. That, you know, he wouldn't ask my sister what she does with her husband. And but of course, straight people justify their ignorance that, well, they just don't know, and they have to know, and it's important to know, so they have to ask these questions, right? And it isn't important to them that the question put the other on the spot. They really want to put the other on the spot. They're coming from an intimidating position. And so I just went right for it. I was not going to play that game with him. So I just simply said, "Dad, you and I both know you don't need a penis for an orgasm."
Right.
And that, of course, my mother pushed back in her chair. You know, she was shocked by the word, by my even speaking out loud the word penis.
Right.
So, you know, but we're talking, you know, 1969. We're not talking about, you know, 2009 or whatever. So, my father said, "Well, I'm glad to hear that you have a sexual life." He said, "I wouldn't want any of my kids not to have that." So he rescued himself in a way from being an ass.
Did that feel like approval or acceptance or?
You know, at the time it didn't feel like anything, because I was so anxious in that position. I felt like I was being
judged and interrogated.
Interrogated is what it was felt like. Yes, and so I don't think I even had a chance to think about what I feel. I was too busy returning the balls to even think about it. But on reflection, I think my first thought after, you know, like a half an hour later, was that that's good. You know, he's given me in a way, he's giving me the okay.
Mm-hmm.
That he actually is happy that I have a sexual life. So that's a good place to start from. And they were relatively sophisticated, so they were able to, later, you know, the next time we got together, to discuss more. And they had been traveling in the world, and so they knew that there were such things as gay
right.
people.
Right, their horizons were broadened through
right.
the experience of travel.
So, but it's like those stories where it's great if it's happening over there, but not in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So, although they felt fine about somebody else's son or daughter who was gay or lesbian, they didn't feel quite so comfortable about me
mm-hmm.
being that. So, there were all kinds of restrictions on me that were just assumed almost. And one of them was that I wouldn't talk about this when there were other people present. They just assumed that it was okay with them, but don't bring it up with friends or family when we're present.
Yeah.
And don't cross over into too much revealing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to know any of the...
Like, be discreet.
Yeah, right. I don't really want to know the details.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know that you are this or that, and then I...
Even though
enough.
They had asked, or your father had
right.
asked initially for,
right.
you know, some
he was challenging
specificity.
Me
yeah.
More than anything. And he was trying to make me feel embarrassed or ill at ease, which would be making him more at ease if he
mm-hmm.
could get me
mm-hmm.
to be the one who was...
Well, he was in control. He
yeah.
wanted, yeah.
So... that was not maybe conscious, but that was how the situation was. So so the family knew, and then I felt free to then be openly gay. And so I started to go through my friends list and make dates with people who were in town and to go out for coffee or whatever and tell them. And those that were a long distance, I wrote letters or called, and till I could check off every friend that I knew on my list and said, okay, they all know now.
But it was important for you to make sure that everybody in your circle
mm-hmm.
Knew.
Right.
Out of the gate. I mean, that's what I find, that's what I'm hearing, is that you just wanted, you know, you were out, you were comfortable with your sexual orientation, and that you wanted everybody to be included in that experience of
not so much that I wanted them to be included in it, because there were lots of people I didn't want at all included, but I wanted to be who I am in their circle
mm-hmm.
or anywhere in the world. I wanted to, from that day on, I wanted to be true to myself.
Got it.
And I didn't want to have to go around anymore switching my pronouns and lying about who I was
mm-hmm.
or hiding who I am. And so so really it was for me that I let everybody that knew me know, let them all know right away so that you know, they heard from me. And there were a couple drop-offs.
Were there?
Yeah, subtle ones. There were a couple drop-offs and people that I wasn't really close to begin with, and so that was just easy for them to take me out of their Rolodex.
Yeah.
You know?
Was there still a sting with that sort of?
No.
Okay, got it.
Then not for me,
because
mm-hmm. I wasn't looking for acceptance.
Right.
What started this whole coming out actually? It was an act of my concern about others' feelings. What happened was that my father was arranging for the whole family to get together down in Florida, where we are now, for Christmas. And so he was communicating with all of us, all, that's just three children and my parents, at what dates would be good and when we'd be free and what do you want to do and so forth. And so that pushed me to tell him the truth, because I didn't want to lie to him and give him some other reason why I wasn't going to be able to make it with the family. So that was when I decided I would tell them and then everybody else.
Was Allison invited? Would she have been included in the holiday together?
No, not.
Or anything?
We were together for 10 years, and in those 10 years, we were included at all holidays with the family, but not at holiday parties where others were present.
Mm-hmm.
So only in their home, like if there was a party during the week that they were all going to, would be unlikely that we would be invited to do that, certainly in the beginning. And my parents started this habit of, right away, of having Allison and me to visit them when nobody else in the family was there. So.
Is this because your siblings had not, were they not, did they not
accept
it?
I have no idea why that was. I think it's more likely that it was that mother saw me as trouble in some way. And so if I was in the mix, then nobody would have as much fun with me present as if I wasn't there, then they would have more fun. And it wasn't strictly because of my lesbianism, although that was part of it. It was that I was out. It was that I was of a personality that was being genuine and out. And as a result of being genuine myself, I really wanted others to be genuine. So I would ask them the same things they would ask me. And I wouldn't keep their secrets. And so that was trouble. They couldn't count on me being loyal in that way that, you know. So, and I think also that my mother, who just really engineered everything, that she really liked seeing her kids one at a time. Or maybe it was that she liked having my brother and sister and their families without me, because I was weird. You know, I didn't have children. I didn't have, they all fit with one another, and I didn't fit. And so it was clear from the beginning that that was being, how I was invited was dependent upon that.
Mm-hmm. Now, were your siblings there? Were they... did they accept you? Did they embrace you?
No. They had various feelings, I think.
Okay.
They acted as though they were cool about it, and then they would act as though I was the crazy one in the family, or they would act as though all that I was a gift to them, because then they became favorites and they were
interesting.
They got a little higher on the ladder by me being kicked down to the bottom rung.
Interesting.
And so there were parts of it that were they saw as advantageous, and it was around that time that my parents had always been punishers and rewarders with money. So that's how they showed favor or lack of favor. So I could see right away that that was going to become a service to my brother and sister, that things would be split just down halfies now, not by thirds. And it was true all the way to my father's death, in which I was not mentioned, and my sister and brother even omitted me from the obituary. So I wasn't even named as a family member. And that was just to keep me from finding out that my dad had died and possibly making trouble once again by contesting a will or whatever, right? Well, they didn't know me at all, so what they were doing is they were supposing that I would act the way they would.
Mm-hmm.
And so so that they know how they would act. They would want some of that money. And so they expected that I would want some of that money. And so we were estranged for like 30 years. And when my sister and I got together just 5 years ago, then we shared all these stories, and that's how I found out I was troubled and why, what was behind several things. Yeah.
So the details were only revealed to you recently. So did you just sort of speculate?
Well, yeah,
like,
you could see
that
it was pretty obvious, and
yeah.
They were my family, so I knew all their moves. You know,
yeah. You were familiar.
Pretty easy to read them, and nobody was trying to hide their feelings. They were happy for me to know that they thought I was weird, and so at various times we were together for a funeral or something, but then we would not see each other for years, and then something more else would happen. And so it was, and then at one point I broke it off entirely with them, because they were, my mother in particular, was still, somehow because I wasn't married in the traditional way, it meant when your kids marry, you can kind of take your hands off of them a bit. They have their own life.
You feel less responsibility, is that it? Or?
I don't know what it is. I guess it's more respect is what it is. You give them more respect that they now can create their own. As long as I was married, I didn't deserve that kind of respect. So my mother would want to know everything that was going on with me. And would judge my life. I got so that I just didn't want that anymore. I didn't want my relationship with my family to be all about them judging me or punishing me when I didn't do what they act the way they wanted me to act. And these were could be little things. I mean, the way I walk across the room, for instance. So I just thought, enough of this. I don't need this. So the next time I was out of favor for one thing or another, who knows what it was at that time, I think it was probably that my brother had divorced and I had remained friendly with his ex. And so I think that was the issue that finally gave them the right to exclude me. Again, I hadn't been loyal in a way. So I never did see my mother and father in their old age, interesting enough.
So you never saw them again after that?
No, I didn't. I nor speak to them again. When my mother died, I found out not from my immediate family, but from nieces and nephews, I found out that mother had died. And I called my dad and prepared for him not to even talk to me, but he did talk to me briefly. But it was clear when I said, well, I'd like to see you, and he said, well, not now. Mm. So it was clear that I wasn't welcome to come to the funeral or whatever. And then when he died, again, I found out through a niece, and they were having a private little get-together, just family, and they just assumed I wouldn't be there, and they were correct to assume that. I actually felt quite relieved when they died, because they had no power over me at that point. And so even though I wasn't in a close relationship with them, they still had some kind of a pull or shadow that they cast over my life.
It's incredible that all this stemmed out of your communicating to them that you're a lesbian.
Right.
I mean, that's that.
Right. Yeah. It's another time.
I will never be able to get my head around that, you know.
That you could be rejected. Well,
I mean, it was that was not my experience. So
no,
it's really.
It's not most.
It seems.
Yeah.
It's so cruel.
Yeah. Well, if you can discard somebody that easily, then it has to be that you don't have very strong feelings in the first place. And
it's hard to say. I mean,
yeah, I never knew.
I mean, I feel like they must, you know, your parents must have loved you, but they just couldn't come to terms with you being a lesbian.
You know, people always are saying that they must have loved you. And according to their idea of love, not according to my idea of love.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't love that that casts a member's side for being just themselves. They had feelings for me, certainly, but nothing that was... real that caused them to want me in their life. They were happy to not have me around.
I mean, so do you feel that, you know, where we are now, for example,
mm-hmm.
I mean, do you feel that it's
yeah,
that it's dramatically different than...
It's two generations. It's 50 years for someone young right now coming out. So that's a generation is usually 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you know, when the Supreme Court passed the equal...
marriage equality?
Marriage equality,
yeah.
It seemed to me that it was so, like, sudden. Because for 50 years, there was nothing. And then suddenly, everything was coming around.
Mm-hmm.
Never thought it would happen in my lifetime. But growing up in the 50s and 60s and growing up at the millennials,
mm-hmm.
At the turn of the century, wow, what a difference, a huge difference. So this project that you're doing of pulling those generations together in some way
mm-hmm.
is a great idea because life was totally different.
Yeah,
50 years ago,
and that history, having a point of reference, having understanding your history, it seems critical, you know,
mm-hmm.
In any effort to move forward,
mm-hmm.
to make progress. I think it feels to me that it's important to reflect on a history, to be educated in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to understand the timeline and
mm-hmm.
and how far we've come, and I don't know, these conversations to me are incredibly important.
Yeah, right.
And provide so much insight.
Well, I felt that one of the gifts in my life was to be excommunicated, because it was so comfortable. They were all well-to-do, and it was so comfortable. There was no growth, and I would have ended up, if I had been in that group, I would have ended up just like they ended up, and I didn't want to end up like that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted something different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I often feel as though my homosexuality was one of my gifts, and because it's turned out to weed out some of the bad characters, and
mm-hmm.
It's given me a life of a lot more enlightenment. And I had two long-term relationships. One was 10 years and one was 16 years. I was in the first relationship when I met Catherine, who was my wife for 16 years. My relationship with Allison had cooled down, and we were like family. We were no longer romantically in involved. And so it was only natural that one or the two of us would finally find somebody mm-hmm. who would be a lover.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just a matter of time. And it, so it was 10 years when it happened.
It was an amicable
separation. Well, it was painful.
Sure.
But it was not, we remained friends. And we worked our way through the rough spots so that we could be friends. And then, but both of them have now passed. So the Allison also died a year after Catherine. So, yeah.
So how, I mean, how is that now, you know, 20, or, you know, 50 years later, right? As an older member of the LGBTQ community, where do you find yourself? I mean, how are you feeling now at 75?
You know, it's like, I've been in the larger world that is an inclusive world. So I don't think of myself as, somebody in the gay world, because my world is so much broader than that. So I don't really have an answer for that question, but when I think about my place historically, is that my place was between the non-existence and then the open acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the travelers between those two extremes. And so, in a way, we were the journey people who made the journey, got us to that point. Yeah.
So let me understand. So you feel, first of all, it sounds like there's so much gratitude for the experience that you've had, for the journey you've had
mm-hmm.
since, you know, talking about when you
mm-hmm.
when you started talking about it in 1969. And what I hear is there's pain and love and all those things that we experience as part of the human condition. But I also hear from you, I mean, you sound grateful for your life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
oh, yeah.
not over yet.
Right.
But,
oh, yeah,
I
actually am very grateful. I'm so glad that... that I was different than the other members of my family, and so was pushed out of the nest.
But I mean, do you feel any isolation or?
I feel more isolation as a result of age than
right.
I do sexual orientation.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Some of my friends, some of them are gone.
Right.
The most important one, my wife, is gone. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm, from the time that she passed, I feel a little bit that I've been pretending at life and going through the motions and not fully in it the way I was when I was married.
Like anticipating something or just biding your time? You know what I mean? Is that, what is it?
I'm being a good girl. And surviving,
yeah.
But I'm not. There are times when the surviving is not great.
Mm-hmm.
My relationship with Catherine was so wonderful, that our life was so great, that nothing could really compete with that.
Mm-hmm.
And when she died young, she was 55 and I was 52. So that's a long time to be a widow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the book that I've just published is about. That in order to manage, I wrote letters to her.
Yeah.
And that was my survival.
Well, it's like you have to continue to communicate, don't you think? I mean,
well, yeah.
With everything, with your experiences,
mm-hmm.
with... you know, the tangible and the intangible, just continue the conversation with your existence, past and present, and
mm-hmm.
that all I'm learning more
well,
and more every day seems more
yeah.
important.
It's the connections in life that count.
Yeah.
And
like this.
When you and when you feel isolated, it's because you don't feel connected somehow.
That's exactly right.
And so then you have to make an effort to connect again.
Yeah.
And that's, but when you're young and in love, you're not making any effort to connect. It's just you are connected,
yeah.
you know, and you don't know how lucky you are
yeah.
until you don't have that. And then
yeah.
And then you know how lucky you were. But so when I say I'm sort of like going through the motions, it's like because I feel like I'm having to consciously survive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have to be a good girl and do eat my vegetables
mm-hmm.
and go to bed and wake up and continue with life.
Which is something we're always aware of. It's not like we, you know, we are taught to do that.
Right.
But it's interesting through the different, you know, different seasons of our lives.
Yeah.
How, and we consistently revisit that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, and I find it to be a, sort of a positive thing that, you know, in the winter of our lives or whatever, that we typically, it seems like we become more conscious of it. And I think that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And reflecting on our lives, even in the midst of, you know, some isolation that we feel as we age, is comforting. Does that make any sense? I know that we're, but
near the end, yeah.
But,
there's always more to talk about.
There, that's true. Well, it's like this, you know,
yeah.
I mean, you and I met.
Yeah.
I feel like we became fast friends.
Yeah.
There seems to be this shared philosophy to some extent.
Yeah.
And, but just the opportunity to be together, look at each other,
uh-huh.
and talk.
Yeah.
Is, it's fulfilling. It's profound. You
yeah.
know, it. It
yeah.
makes, personally, just, I mean, it makes my heart feel good.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the connection thing.
Yeah.
To me, I'm convinced of two things that are necessary in life to live. And that is connections and desire.
Mm.
You have to desire something to get up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just a tuna fish sandwich at lunch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be a big thing. It just has to get you to lunch.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have to have something else to get you. And that's more and more true the older we get.
Yeah.
That life gets harder and harder. We get more and more limited. And we have less and less to look forward to. So we have to start looking forward to a tuna fish sandwich.
But it simplifies on some level, you know? I mean, it seems like ultimately it becomes so focused.
Yeah.
That's what I'm discovering,
yeah.
is it becomes so focused, and you really truly understand, I would hope, as you approach the end of your life, how important the simple things are.
Yes.
You know? And I'm just really grateful that
yeah.
we met.
Yeah, me too, Robert.
Uh-huh. And that we have had the opportunity to get to know each other, and
yeah.
this conversation has meant a lot. And, you know,
well, I hope so.
The more you get to know somebody,
mm-hmm.
you know, the deeper the connection. And like you said, that's what it's all about, ultimately.
Yeah.
So I really thank you for coming in to talk with me.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. Yeah.
And we'll continue the conversation.
What better thing could I do on a Monday?
On a Monday at 10 o'clock, right?
Right, exactly.
Well, Joan, thanks so much.
Okay,
thank you. That's amazing. I mean, look, we're at 44. Oh, yes, we're done.